violation against PBI communication system.
Good morning. May it please the court. Zenith appeals in this case from a summary judgment granted by the district court finding the two Zenith patents in issue here, the 301 and the 513, invalid, as well as finding the 301 patent, claims 1 to 4, not infringed by reason of implied license. We ask this court respectfully to reverse that decision on several grounds. First, we believe the district court wrongly construed the claims, claim 1 of each of the two patents. Second, it decided disputed issues of fact and ignored inconsistent and contrary facts.
Brown, let me ask you, if, assume for the moment, I realize, and you make the argument forcefully in your brief, but assume for the moment that one were to conclude that the district court properly construed the, what I'll call by way of shorthand, and you'll know what I'm talking about, the power source limitation in 301. Assume that construction was correct. Where does that leave you with respect to the anticipation issue based on the prior art television and controller?
Well, it still leaves that issue lacking, Your Honor, because what happened in addition to the construction is we believe the court improperly shifted the burden of proof to Zenith, the non-mover. And secondly, as I said, there were disputed issues of fact here. And one of those, with respect to invalidity on the 301 and also the 513, is a lack of any evidence of public use under 102B.
Okay, but no, I understand you make that argument, and that relates to the prior art. Is there any other claim limitation at issue?
There's no other claim. The parties submitted claim terms initially long prior to the close of discovery. And the court, except for in the 513.
But what I'm talking about, in claim one of the 301 patent, okay?
Yes.
The only limitation at issue is that you're complaining about is
supplying operating
power
to the multifunction encoder. That's correct, Your Honor.
Right.
That's correct. And what we're saying, obviously, is the district court backed into its construction by looking at the extrinsic evidence of anticipation. But what we're also saying is that if the court construes operating power the way it does, simply meaning power generated by the television receiver to the pillow speaker, it comes out with the anomalous result that all of the prior art that's discussed in the patent, including the prior analog or key closure of pillow speakers, are then subject to invalidating that patent.
Okay, but assume that claim construction is correct. Is there any dispute that limitation is met in the prior art?
With his particular claim construction, Your Honor.
If you accept that claim construction.
With that broad claim construction, I don't think that we can say that's not met either by assuming that the
point of view. Why is that? Assuming it's prior art.
Assuming that that's prior art, we can't disagree that that's met. But like I said, it's also met by all of the analog pillow speakers because every one of those pillow speakers drew power from the TV.
Okay.
The television was a source of
power. And none of the other, and it's not disputed that the other limitations are met in prior art.
The other limitations we have no particular dispute over. It's just this one operating power, and the reason is because we think the district court obviously should have gone to the specification.
So if one accepts the district court's claim construction vis-a-vis claim one of the 301 patent, on the validity issue, what it really comes down to is, was there a public use?
Was there a public use? Did the court proceed in a proper way? Was there evidence? Really, it comes down to, was there evidence of public use? The only evidence of public use is Mr. Mengel's declaration, where he says that they were in public use. PDI never, for instance, took any evidence from the people who would be the direct infringers of the users, such as the hospitals, or patients in the hospitals, or others. There's no evidence, there's no scintilla of evidence that the steps of the method of that claim one were in public use prior to the critical date. All there is Mr. Mengel's declaration statement. As we've pointed out, Mr. Mengel is a somewhat unusual witness in that he is not only a fact witness because he purported to contribute to the circuit of the 205E pillow speaker that Cravel made, but he also became the expert for PDI in this case, and he also was employed by RCA, one of Zenith's largest competitors in this market for over 30 years, and he was continuing to consult for him.
I gather that you didn't submit or attempt to submit contrary declarations or evidence, but rather relying on where the burdens were placed and on the position that there was a burden to come forward with contrary evidence, and that's the case that we made conversation.
Well, we do have contrary evidence here. We have contrary evidence in the form of Mr. Mudra's test report. He was the inventor of the patents in suit. With contrary evidence
on the public use issue.
Mr. Cook. On the public use issue, we thought it was not our burden to do that. It was not our burden to show that there was a prior public use. Therefore, we didn't submit evidence that there wasn't a public use. That's what we talk about when we say he shifted the burden of proof here. Erroneously to Zenith. That's
it. Depends on how much weight the district court is entitled to place on an uncontroverted statement that there was a public use.
And that's why we also made a motion to disqualify Mr. Mengel under Daugherty, and we also made a motion to strike his declaration that was filed at the time of filing the summary judgment. Mr. Mengel had two depositions, one as a fact witness, one as an expert, and he submitted two different reports. And in none of these papers does he submit evidence saying, I was there, I saw it. He didn't see it because he had been transferred to the satellite television division of RCA at the time that he purports to have made the statement. There's no support. There's just no evidence or no corroboration for what he said, so we didn't believe it's our burden to go out and find out whether or not this happened. It's their burden
unless
to show.
It's contradicted. You're saying it needed to be corroborated even though it wasn't contradicted.
It wasn't. We're saying it needed, what we did, rather than submitting a contrary declaration, which would be to try to prove a negative, would be to say that he had no support for that, Judge, so you can't look at that where he doesn't support that. But we did show that he himself was not available at the time that he purported to make the statement. In other words, he wasn't involved with this particular product or process at that time, so he couldn't have known. And we, in fact, you know, there's deposition testimony that's cited from Mr. Mengel where he actually says that he was transferred to this other division, and that after he gave the circuit to Cravel, he really had nothing else to do with it. So what we're concluding there with the court is there's no basis for him to make that statement. So, and the other, in terms of the burden of proof, in the 513 analysis that was done by the district court, it's probably more clear how he shifted the burden to Zenith on the invalidity question. For example, in his opinion at A14, it says, Zenith does not specifically point to any other element of the claim it contends was not anticipated by the J20525. Now this goes back, I think, Judge Newman, to kind of your question. What did we do in response to that? Or what did we do on the J2525? Did we submit evidence that each of the elements of the method steps of the 513 was not anticipated? No, we did not, because Mr. Mengel's declaration doesn't go through the steps. He doesn't say, I saw this step practiced that by these two combinations. He doesn't say that. He talks about distinguishing, but that only goes to one particular step and doesn't even use the exact claim language. So in that case, again, it's not our burden to do that. That's PDI's burden. But the district court clearly shifted that burden back to us, saying we don't show any evidence that it didn't perform that way. So I would just say that there is evidence, Cook and Mudra, as to how they believe the combination of the prior art worked. And for example, with respect to the Cravel 205E, it basically was the same thing as a battery-powered pillow speaker, because the supercapacitor that they used, all it could do was absorb a charge. And even the Cravel employees say that it would function just like a battery. So again, this goes back in some ways to the claim construction and terms of operating power, which I think we've pretty clearly gone into in our brief. But nevertheless, that evidence is there as to what our expert, who has a background in remote controls, is an electrical engineer, and Mr. Mudra, who is a longtime electrical engineer with Zenith, how they believe that production combination works, and that was in contradistinction to Mr. Mengel's evidence. We also proved that with respect to the 513 and that particular claim term there, and program to ignore it, that Mr. Mengel was inconsistent. And that was again part of our motion to strike that was ignored by the district court. Because Mr. Mengel in his deposition said that it was not programmed not to ignore, that the prior art did recognize key closures. But yet he comes back in his declaration, and while he doesn't use the words programmed to ignore, he says it differentiates. And that's again where the district court got into trouble, because there are two different steps that we're focusing on in the 513 claim. One is decoding data pulses with a microprocessor programmed to ignore. And the other one is detecting key closures with a timing circuit. Well, the differentiation for key closures, voltage signal, is the detecting step, and that's the timing circuit. And so what Mr. Mengel does in his declaration, he doesn't use any of the language of the claim. He simply uses the word distinguish, and that's picked up by the district court. When the district court says that, well, as long as you can differentiate between the two, you know, that anticipates the claim. Well, that's rewriting the claim language, and that's simply wrong. If I could comment a minute on the implied license.
Yes, please do.
One of the problems in the implied license is that the court here never considered the device that was supposedly subject to the license, that is, the pillow speaker that was a subject of the license agreement. So the court never considered whether there was a 1997 pillow speaker or a 2003 pillow speaker, which are completely different animals. So the court never looked at what the, quote, licensed apparatus was.
But whatever they are, whatever the titles were, speakers, patents were licensed to the seller, right? With no restrictions.
The patents were licensed to the manufacturers of the pillow speakers, who then sold. Right. But we... Again, from the Metcoil cases, we know from implied license, we have to show that in that case that there's no non-infringing uses. In other words, the mere existence of the license agreement shouldn't carry the day.
If the patents were licensed, how can the owner of the patent go after a user, a purchaser from a licensee?
Well, without getting into the exhaustion theory, basically on the implied license theory, what we need to show is that there are other uses of the licensed product, so that there are non-infringing, and actually PDI has to prove that there's no non-infringing uses.
But the problem here is that this is, in fact, the same use for which, from everything that we've seen, that the devices were sold.
Well, that's where another controversy arises. Because the testimony that we submitted in response to that was from the general manager of the two largest pillow, general managers of the two largest pillow speaker makers, and they say, number one, they understood that these pillow speakers were only for Zenith, so there was a restriction. So they were only for Zenith, and the second thing...
The restriction wasn't in the license.
Well, that it's not in the terms of license, but it's expressed in the intent, Judge. It says, the license agreement specifically says...
Looking to the whereas clause.
Right. And the court simply said, well, you can't read a whereas as a term. And I would agree with that, but you can read under Illinois law a whereas to express the intent of the parties.
If the intent may not be entirely clear. But I don't think the whereas clause could undo, if you will, one would read as clearly expressed intent otherwise.
Well, the clearly expressed intent, and this goes back again to some of the other depositions of Mr. Mudra and Mr. Kale, was what was the reason for these? The reason in 1996 is there were only Zenith in the market because these pillow speakers have Zenith codes. In fact,
The whereas clause is talked in terms of compatibility of Zenith televisions. It didn't talk about intent to license only.
Well, it does talk about available to buyers of its commercial televisions in the whereas clause. And one says, whereas Zenith desires to have said compatible pillow speaker available to buyers of its.
That's a positive statement rather than a restriction. It doesn't say to no one else.
Well, I would
say only.
And I would, but I would argue from the actual facts as to what the pillow speaker makers thought, that they believed, and they only paid royalties on the Zenith, on products used with the Zenith television set. They didn't pay royalties.
The licensee paid no royalties under the patent?
The licensees did.
That were sold for other uses?
They paid royalties to Zenith up until 2003. Up until that point in time, there was no other TV that these pillow speakers were usable with. As a practical matter, they generated Zenith codes. They were only usable with Zenith. They couldn't use them with an RCA or a Philips TV. So as an actual matter, they were restricted by the very construction. In fact, Zenith supplied the encoder chips to the pillow speaker makers to make these. So there was a basic understanding that they were only usable with this particular product.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Let me address first, since we were just talking about the implied license issue. There is exactly zero limitations in the license agreements that Zenith granted on the 301 patent to restrict Cabell, MedTech, and the other pillow speaker manufacturers from selling pillow speakers to hospitals that are going to use them with televisions other than Zenith televisions. There's no evidence in the record with respect to this last issue of paying of royalties on some TVs and not others. It's just not germane to the issue because the license agreements speak for themselves. And they say that the licensed apparatus is any pillow speaker the use of which is covered by the licensed patents. And that's exactly what the situation is here.
But let's just assume that it were feasible, that there was in fact evidence that the parties understood that these are the only televisions with which it's compatible and with which it can be used, and therefore that the whereas clause states the intention and the background under which the entire agreement is to be construed. Where does that lead us?
If you were to make those assumptions that there was evidence to point to the pillow speaker manufacturers having an implicit understanding that the license was limited to use with Zenith televisions, then presumably they would have told the hospitals, we will sell you these pillow speakers, you may only connect them to Zenith TVs. There's absolutely no evidence that that occurred.
There would have been role evidence probably not relevant unless the written provision was ambiguous.
Right, exactly. And there is no ambiguity. The license language, as I just recited it, the license grant clause is quite clear as it defines licensed apparatus as any pillow speaker, the use of which is covered by the licensed patents. Interestingly enough, it's the use of the licensed pillow speakers with my client's televisions that's accused of infringement. I mean, it's that very act that's the direct infringement. My client is accused of contributory infringement because it sells the TVs, and it has a minimal amount of direct infringement alleged against it because it tests its TVs with pillow speakers on site.
What about the issue of unpatented use?
Non-infringing use?
Non-infringing.
The pillow speakers have control buttons on them, which include the control of televisions, and which include sometimes nurse call buttons, light controls, and perhaps radio controls. So those are uses that this pillow speaker could be put to, but they're in addition to the use of the pillow speaker. The pillow speaker is still plugged into the TV, still powered by the TV, and still, at least sometimes, used to control the TV. There's been no evidence that patients are lying in their bed controlling the lights with this pillow speaker and never using it to control the TV. If that's the case, and Zenith wants to take that position, that would be fine because then our clients supplying TVs that aren't controlled by the pillow speakers wouldn't be an infringement anyway. You can't have it both ways. There's either contributory infringement because of the combined use, or there's no non-infringing use because the combination is used exactly for the purpose that it's sold. It's kind of like saying you have a patented automobile that's got lights and a radio and a navigation system. It's still a patented car just because you turn on the lights, or just because you turn on the radio, or just because you turn on the nav system. And so I think that argument really doesn't fly in the specific context of these facts.
Terrence, I have two questions, and I can't promise this, but when you answer them, I may not bother you anymore. The first one is this. It relates to the 301 patent.
Okay.
My discussion with Mr. Brown frames this a little bit. Mr. Brown says, okay, he said, assuming one accepts the district court's claim construction, the issue on validity, anticipation, comes down to whether the prior art, the RCA television, the other switcher, were in public use. Right? You heard him say that.
Yes.
And he said, the problem I have with the district court's conclusion on that is that all PBI has done is come forward with a manual testimony. There's nothing else. He said there's no corroboration for manual. You heard him say that, right?
I sure did.
So he's pointing, obviously looking at our Finnegan case, saying that you have to have corroboration. Now, what in the record, where in the record is there support for the public use ruling of the court that would corroborate what Mr. Mangle said in his declaration, I guess his deposition? What do you point to other than that? You just give me the sites.
Okay. I'll first give you the specific section of our brief that has about 10 pages of sites, so that might be out of nature. But our brief, our primary brief at page 17 through page 28 recites, in addition to the Mangle declaration, it cites to, interestingly enough, Zenith's own brief, where they argue that the combination of the pillow speaker and the television were unsuccessful 45% of the time. Now, I understand that to mean that it was successful 60% of the time or 55% of the time, which seems to me an admission that they were used together. So now we might be in the position of trying to determine.
Let's not weigh that. If something fails half the time, it's hard to say that controls. What else is there?
Okay. Well, so you've got the fact that we have in evidence a vintage television. So we had the actual TV, which was tested not only by their expert and ours, and apparently Mr. Mudra, the inventor. So we have the physical existence of the television. We've got dated and corroborated literature. Excuse me, I should be giving you citations. So A2130 was the statement in Zenith's brief. The declaration of Mangle we've talked about, that's at 1458.
Yeah, we're looking for corroboration of that.
In addition, we've got Mr. Mudra's memorandum at 1545 in the appendix, where he specifically mentions that the RCA and this pillow speaker with the capacitor were in use, but they had to change to a battery version, and he said that was years.
So what you're saying, just to so because I don't want to use up all your time, Mr. Terrence, what you're saying is if you look, if one marches through pages 17 through 28 of your brief, one will find there evidence by way of corroboration for the Mangle statement with respect to prior use.
I believe you will.
Second and question is this, turning to the 513 patent, and I guess claim one, and again the validity issue, where in the record, in other words, as we know, to have an anticipated reference, the reference has to contain all the limitations of the claim, right?
Correct.
Okay. Where in the record do we have evidence of anticipation with respect to the last two limitations of claim one of the 513 patent? Specifically, the patent is at A78 attached to the blue brief. The limitations are detecting said closure with a timing circuit and operating key closure identification circuitry in response to said timing circuit. In other words, I didn't see those two, at least in the record, maybe I missed it, but I didn't see those two limitations discussed, and I didn't see evidence of anticipation in the prior art with respect to those limitations. What do you point to?
May I make one comment?
Do you understand my question?
I exactly understand your question. Let me just make one brief comment before I answer it, if I may. And that is that, as the district court pointed out, and I understand that this isn't completely controlling, but they pointed out that Zenith made no argument that there was any other missing element in the prior art other than the program to ignore limitation.
Well, they did say, maybe I'm being a little bit generous in my reading, but I did take a look going back into the record of the response to the motions and so forth, to your motion, and they did complain about facts in dispute and so forth. And also, I didn't see really any statement in your presentation of undisputed facts with respect to these two elements. So I hear what you're saying, but I kind of think this is a little bit fair game.
Absolutely. And so to specifically answer your question, our approach on those two points, I don't have a cite for you, and our argument went like this. The television that was accused of infringing, the current day PDI model, also doesn't have those features, but yet it's argued to infringe. So our position was that our TV, which doesn't have those features, infringes. The prior art, which may or may not have those features, but still operates the same way and differentiates between the data pulses and the key closures, that which is infringes if later, anticipates it sooner, that was our theory, and the district court went for that because the primary issue had to do with the differentiation between the two types of signals and not so much on the circuitry of the key closure identification. So I don't have a site for you,
I will have to take, I don't want to speak for everybody, but from my view, I have to take a look at that. It strikes me as maybe a little bit thin.
It is.
What the law has said we have to meet vis-a-vis anticipation.
And I will not deny that that's probably our thinnest argument.
I've taken enough of your time, Mr. Ahrens. I'll let you get back to other tasks there.
Including your cross-appeal.
Yes.
We
identified two separate points in our cross-appeal. One had to do with the district court's dismissal of our inequitable conduct counterclaim, and the second was its, without explanation, denial of awarding costs to PDI. Just briefly on the cost issue, PDI clearly was the prevailing party in this matter, and the court just said no costs. And provided no explanation. And the Seventh Circuit law would require, if nothing else, an explanation, even if it was going to say
that. That surely has to be a minor issue.
It is very, that's all I'm going to say about it.
Take that away.
With respect to the matter of the unenforceability, the district court treated the counterclaim on unenforceability in two ways. In one aspect, regarding claims 2 through 8 of the 513 patent, it dismissed the counterclaim with prejudice. Can't be raised again as a defense to those claims. And those claims were not found invalid and were not found to be non-infringed. So those claims, on remand, if this case were to be remanded, would be alive and well to be asserted against my client, but we have no defense of inequitable conduct, according to the district court. Now, as this court well knows, inequitable conduct, if found, or unenforceability, it renders all claims of the patent unenforceable, not just one or 3 or 6 or 2, but it would render them all unenforceable. So our position was.
Didn't we have the trial judge who reaches a conclusion whereby your client is not liable under the charges brought by Z? And so we're saying, nonetheless, that the judge was obliged to go back and review a lot of other issues in case other claims are later asserted. You see that as something that the law permits now to come back and say whether the law lost on claim one
going to sue you again on claim 2?
Well, we were sued on claims 2 through 8 of the 513 patent. No, in this lawsuit, in this particular case.
So that's why I'm trying to understand where you said that they come back on other claims and you are precluded from raising defenses.
My understanding of the dismissal with prejudice of our counterclaim regarding the specific claims 2 through 8, we would be precluded from raising that again.
Judge says the case is open. You've won.
Well,
the liability issues, it's truly whatever it was, whatever equities were balanced or so on in the past, and you won.
Well, he
wanted to review up.
Or is it that you want attorney fees?
Well, 2 points. One is he dismissed their claim for infringement under 2 through 8 without prejudice. So that can be raised again. They're not foreclosed from asserting those claims against my client.
Are they not foreclosed if they prevail on this appeal?
They are not. That's true. But we would be because our counterclaim was dismissed with prejudice. That's the dichotomy, is that they have a viable claim that can go forward and we have a defense that's not going to be committed.
The other thing, Nate, Mr. Harris, let's assume for the moment one were to say that there was a problem with the determination of invalidity of claim 1. Okay? That would go back to the district court. Now, there is a footnote in the district. It appears the district court said, so assume for the moment one were to send the validity issue back. Now, claim 1 is alive and kicking then in terms of validity. So then the question is, has there been a ruling that claim 1 was non-infringed? Okay. I couldn't see a ruling by the district court to that effect. It seemed to me that the district court said claim 1 is non-infringed because he was finding the claim invalid.
Well, and because of the implied license. There is no infringement.
No, I'm talking about the 513 patent.
Oh, I'm sorry, yes.
You're talking about the 513 patent.
Right. There is no, there's not two bases for our exculpatory. I'm out of time.
See, what I'm saying is, I can see claim 1 going back saying, you know, it hasn't been established it's invalid, number 1. And number 2, it hasn't been established that it was not infringed.
Right.
Hence, in that context, the inequitable conduct defense would be valid with respect to, I don't know if it had merit,
right,
but it would be.
It's a viable defense.
It would be viable, yes, with respect to the 513,
absolutely,
leaving aside claims 2 through 8.
Yes, because it was dismissed without prejudice as to that claim.
Yeah.
So, thank you very much.
Any questions? Thank you, Mr.
Harris.
Mr. Brown.
Thank you, Your Honor. And just my reaction to the last part is that that was our point, is that the mootness, if it goes back and it's retried again, they do have a chance to bring that in. If Mr. Ahrens is correct, and that they prove inequitable conduct, then all claims of that patent are.
Do you agree, Mr. Brown, that it, assume we send, again, I have to speak hypothetically, obviously, but assume we send claim 1 of the 513 back to the district court on the grounds that there wasn't enough to establish invalidity. Okay?
Right.
Am I correct in thinking that the only reason there's that footnote by the judge, or whatever it is, saying that claim 1 of the 513 was not infringed was because of what he said on validity?
That's the way we read the case, right?
I mean, that, it seemed that Mr. Ahrens saw it the same way.
Right, so, and the way we read it is that they get to reinstate their inequitable conduct.
Inequitable conduct,
right,
if one goes back.
So that's why we're
totally talking, irrespective of the case, with respect, whatever the deal is on 2 through 8.
Right.
No. But are both sides also in agreement that if the district court was correct on the theory of implied license, that the controversy disappears?
Well, no, it doesn't disappear with the 513. The implied license only goes to the 301 patent. So, no, it only was a finding of non-infringement on the claims 1 to 4 of the 301 patent based on the implied license. I just wanted to speak to that briefly. Is to, you know, again reiterate the difference between implied license and exhaustion, in that we're not talking about exhaustion here of method claims. We're talking about whether or not a license should be implied, and under the Met Coil and Vanguard decisions and other decisions of this court, you have to have PEI coming forward with evidence of no non-infringing uses. And what we're saying is, not only did they not do that, in fact, the trial judge admits they did not do that. So what he does, he steps in and he says, well, here's this license agreement. So therefore, if it's licensed, you know, therefore, it must be an implied license. But, and we're saying, no, the license shouldn't carry that much weight. It shouldn't carry the entire weight, because obviously things like cell phones are subject to numerous licenses. So can any one licensee claim that just because it's, I've got a license, that it implies a license all the way down the line? The other factor here is that Zenith put those licenses out there, and the, first of all, they paid 15 cents on a unit that cost $60 to $150, and a television cost several hundred dollars. Zenith would have never entered into that type of an agreement, thinking it was totally restricting its ability down the line on a combination to operate a combination that was worth several hundred dollars. The other point here is that the testimony of the pillow speaker makers is they don't pay license fees to Zenith on the PDI television. So it really is a non-licensed product. That license agreement doesn't operate with respect to anybody else's TVs. It's just our own TVs. So it is a restricted license agreement. This is in the record. And finally, Judge Schall, to go to your conversation as to what else they have with 513, or with the 301, we would submit there's nothing else. Mr. Aarons referred to dated literature. Well, the testimony regarding that literature from the people that put it out, which was Crivell, is they're not sure if that literature refers to a battery-operated 205E or the 205E with a supercapacitor. They don't know. So there's no way that that literature really supports anything. Mr. Woodruff's memorandum was created after the fact in 1994 based on hearsay. He had heard things about what happened in the field, and he'd heard about the problems that RCA had had, and in fact, he didn't even want to investigate it because he said it failed. So that's, we just don't think there's sufficient evidence on 301.
Corroboration.
Right. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Bradford, Mr. Aarons. This is taken under submission.
Thank you.
All rise. The Honorable Court is adjourned until tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock a.m.